can motivate us in unconscious ways, and perhaps for our own economic and psychological survival, we might profit from a better understanding of that. Our two guests this hour study the interaction between humans and structures, the intersection of architecture and neuroscience, and we're going to explore a little of what they know, and little is a good word to use in this conversation. Carol Reichardt is the managing partner and president of the Washington, D.C. office of Little Diversified Architectural Consulting. Morning. Welcome to the program.
Morning. Thank you.
David Kepron is Little's creative director, drawing upon more than 20 years of creating new retail brands and store concepts nationally and internationally. He's worked on projects for Perry Ellis, Lacoste, Calvin Klein, Ralph Lauren, and the Museum of Modern Art. Yes, but when will he get some good clients, to name just a few? In short, he understands what makes for an effective selling place, which is part of our conversation. Welcome to you as well.
Good to be here, Mike.
Good morning. What do you think of our little home here?
It's wonderful.
Okay. Start drawing new designs. There seems to be a real, incredible interest in design today, because that seems to be what really sells a lot of products. There are whole cable networks devoted to design in the home environment, particularly in the home environment. Design is obviously what makes Apple so successful, from their products to the stores they sell those products. And many think it's all just about making things pretty. And maybe functional, too. But there's actually a lot more to it than that. And you say that designers and architects need to think about how the built environment relates not only to the human body, but to the human brain. Is this a new way of thinking, or have designers and architects been doing this all along, either consciously or subconsciously?
I think designers have been doing it for a long time, without necessarily knowing exactly why. I think people understand that humans like to be exposed to daylighting. Humans derive some meaning from working with other people. But I think the initiative, the brain initiative that's just been established recently, where NIH, the National Institutes of Health, and other organizations are going in and actually mapping every neuron in the human brain, has brought it to a different level. It's something that's akin to the Human Genome Project, which did the same thing for genetics.
Well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that when you walk into a really well-designed building or a really nice space within that building, you feel good. It makes you relax. It makes you happy. It can also be made, I suppose, to make you do things faster or slower, and we'll talk about that. But you say that it can impact a person's health, really?
Yeah, absolutely.
How so?
In a number of ways. There are initiatives called the Active Design Initiative, which actually help people be more active in a space. We know now that the longer people sit at a desk or at any place in a stationary position for a long period of time, it's actually something that's pathogenic, which is – it doesn't help your health. The best design is salutogenic, which means it's got a beneficial impact on your health.
Explain to me the difference.
Sure.
I spend most of my life sitting now, because I'm either sitting here behind this or I'm sitting behind a computer.
Sure. There have been scientific studies done that show the effects of activity on mice. And they had two sets of mice. One was a sedentary group, basically just put in a tank, and the other group was put in a tank that had a wheel so that they could run. And they measured brain activity, and they measured how quickly they learned things and how quickly they memorized things. And the active mice had actually a 15% increase in the neurons in their brain. So they became smarter. There's neurogeneration, which means the creation of new neurons in your brain. And they were able to learn more quickly, and they were able to retain the memory.
And we've talked on this program about exercise and what it does to the brain, and it's exactly what you're talking about. It increases blood flow in the brain, and it makes the brain work better and retain knowledge, information better. You remember things. You learn more quickly. But how does that apply to a built environment? Are you going to put everybody in an executive position standing up on a treadmill at their desk?
Well, that might be a start. People sort of look at those desks, those treadmill desks, as a novelty. But even if it's just a surface that raises and lowers, you're burning more calories. Essentially, you burn 400 more calories a day if you're standing at a desk that you can operate and make it higher or lower. The treadmill desk is one way to do it, but also just creating a space where people are encouraged to use the stairs more frequently rather than the elevator core. A lot of companies are implementing wellness programs that are paying more attention to getting people up and out of their seats, especially in a workplace, but in other places as well.
And the inverse of this is true. The reverse of this is true, that there are spaces that can make you sick or make you unhealthy. And is it simply the lack of that kind of environment, or is it something else at work?
Well, there are a lot of different facets. There are 100 billion neurons in your brain. So that's a lot of real estate in a small, you know, space. But there are other things like the lack of exposure to natural daylighting is something that is not good for humans. You've got a nice big picture window in your studio here that looks out onto the street. That's actually your body's getting cues from the daylight as it changes from morning light, which has got a higher blue color spectrum, to evening light, which has higher yellow spectrum.
And you say that humans have over 20 senses. I didn't know we had that many. I thought it was, you know, sight, hearing, touch.
Some are more developed than others.
but they're tied to involuntary physiological operations and responses, you say. How many of those are involved in reacting to the built environment? All of them?
I would say yes. I don't know, David, if you feel the same.
I think that's true. I think, you know, you've heard that expression, you only use 10% of your brain. Well, the reality is you're using 100% of your brain 100% of the time, except for maybe when you're in coma or in sleeping, in which case the functional, you know, modules that are working at those periods of time are different. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, your brain is an amazing network of connectivity that ties multiple functional areas together. And they all work in concert to create the experiences we have, the feelings we have, the feelings we have. So when you talk about health, those things that we see in our environment and those things that we see in other people specifically, let's not forget, architects have been building buildings for people. And the people in places are influenced directly by both the architecture, but also very profoundly by the relationships they have with other people. And the environment can play into how you react to certain things. People don't like acute, sharp angle things. They prefer to have things that are more rounded and those things that are less, promote less of a fear response in us. And so we're wired. 500 million years of human developmental history show very clearly that those areas of our brain that have been the oldest areas are often what's running the show, not those things that we typically think are up front in the prefrontal cortex area, executive planning, those things that are related very clearly to rational thought. So we're much more driven by intuitive, emotionally based reactions than we are the other.
So these 20 senses that operate in us, I think it was something I read that you wrote, David.
Oh boy, here we go.
Yeah, no, that when you walk into a new space, you are aware of the light levels and the color of the light, and you're aware of the smells around you, you're aware of texture, you're aware of the pathways you might take through that space. Are those what we're talking about when we talk about some of these 20 things that fire off?
It's interesting because the reality is about 95% of what we call thoughts are happening below the radar. We're not actually thinking about what we're thinking about. And there's some studies that suggest that it's even higher, that a very small portion of what we think about is brought to our conscious awareness. Uh-huh. So all of those things that are below the radar, you walk into a space and you immediately feel the change of temperature. You hear a different sound. Your foot registers through proprioceptive senses what it's like to walk on concrete versus carpet. And your body is always taking in that information. Your brain's an amazingly efficient machine, if you want to call it a machine. And it uses about 20% of your body's energy, though it only takes up about 3% of your body's mass. And so it's very efficient at taking in information and bringing to conscious awareness those things that are most crucial to how you interact and react with environments. So a lot of that goes on unbeknownst to us. It doesn't mean that there isn't any conductor at the helm, and this is a whole concept of mind that the neuroscience world is trying to figure out now. What is mind? Where is it? How do we all know we have one, but we don't really know where it is in the brain? But all those things are happening aside from the things we typically know we're thinking about.
And why is that important to people like you?
In my world, if you're building retail spaces, my objective is to make sure that customers enjoy the space, have positive experiences in space that turn logically into increased buying. It may seem like a Machiavellian kind of thing, design a space that will, you know, turn the customer's brain on or off to want to spend more time, to integrate more more wholly with the brand, those kinds of things.
We're going to talk a lot about that because I think we're all being manipulated in ways that are nefarious, thanks to you, by the way.
Yeah, right.
And others of your ilk.
We're not that bad.
But if you can design a space that is healthier for an individual, that means you can also design a space that is not healthy for the individual. Obviously, I wouldn't think people set out to do that. They set out to do something that works, but right. They're not always successful at it. Or is it that we just didn't know 50 years ago that building these boxy spaces with no natural light and fluorescent lighting and bad ventilation was going to be bad for us?
I definitely think that that's more the case, because people just – it used to be the light bulb is only 135 years old. So mm-hmm. It used to be the sun would come up in the morning. You'd wake up and you'd do your things during the day. You'd do your work, and then the sun would go down and you'd go to sleep for the most part. You might stay up an hour or two past it by a candlelight or firelight. But with the advent of artificial lighting, we're able to do a lot more things. And so we're able to stay up later. But what that does is it messes with some of our natural systems. So internally, we have an internal clock. You've heard that phrase before.
Right.
And it's based on circadian rhythms. Circadian rhythms means something that's within a 24-hour cycle, which is the sunrise, the moonrise, the moonset, etc. So our bodies are used to receiving cues from the natural sunlight in the morning, blue light, tells us to wake up. It gives us a shot of cortisol. It gets you ready for the day. In fact, if you're somebody who has a hard time waking up, if you're not a morning person, quote unquote, they recommend that you go out and sit outside in the sunlight for 15 to 20 minutes, and then you're awake and you're wide awake. Likewise, conversely, in the afternoon with the yellow spectrum light, it tells your body to start preparing to shut down, to go to sleep and release melatonin, which actually helps heal your body. And studies on nurses who do shift work have shown that nurses who used to work around the clock and weren't exposed to natural daylight had a higher incidence of breast cancer, of diabetes, of anxiety disorders, etc. So we're not necessarily aware of our own bodies. And you were asking the question of David before. The reason why it's important is because architects and designers are problem solvers. And in order to do a good job at solving problems, meaning creating spaces that are effective for people, you need to know what you're designing for.
But since Thomas Edison, who invented the light bulb, I think he's at least generally credited
yes.
with doing so. It may not be true. But since Thomas Edison, we've had two kinds of light, pretty much. We've had incandescent light, which is the Thomas Edison bulb, and then we've had fluorescent tubes, which came along, in the 30s, 40s, somewhere in there. And the character of the light from those two instruments is very different.
No question.
And office spaces and retail spaces have traditionally, because it's cheaper to run, fluorescent tubes, have been lit by fluorescence. The color of that light, what does that do to us?
Well, that goes back to the blue light and the yellow light that I was right. speaking about as far as morning light and evening light.
Right.
And what happens is when you're looking at an artificial lighting situation, it's a static light. If you're outside, light changes all day. You may not be aware of it, mm-hmm. but the spectrum of the light changes all day.
And the color of the light.
Mm-hmm. spectrum. But if you're inside and you're not exposed to natural daylight, you don't have that benefit. So you're exposed to a single temperature, which is the color, which mm-hmm. means the color, all day long. And your body's not getting those cues to turn things on and turn things off as it would if you were outside.
But it's getting that fluorescent lighting, mm-hmm. which is blue, which is what? Going to keep us awake and alert at our desk?
Well, theoretically, but it also might keep you awake all night because you're being exposed to blue light later in the day. So if you're lying in bed looking at your devices, your iPhone or your iPad or whatever it is, or your computer, and you have a bad night's sleep, chances are a lot of it may be because of that.
We're going to take a break and come back to talk more about not just the color of light, but the design of spaces and how they can make you do things that you should or shouldn't do. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Hounds, Charlotte's Major League Lacrosse team. Fun for the whole family at historic Memorial Stadium. Final home game of the 2014 season Friday, August 1st. Tickets and details at charlottehounds.com. Well, the new school year is approaching us. I think it starts August 25th, so just under a month away from the first day of school. And we're going to take a look at what's been going on in Raleigh, because the General Assembly has been making a lot of changes to public education, teacher pay, teacher tenure, teacher assistance, rules about charter schools, the status of Common Core standards. All have been debated and in some cases ruled on. We'll hear about all of this from two of the city's leading education reporters, our own Lisa Miller from WFAE News and Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and we get started about that tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, update on efforts to address the child migrant crisis. Senate Democrats and House Republicans offer competing plans and the latest proposals from the White House.
That's the Diane Rehm Show coming up next from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded public radio, we're 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Carol Reichardt is with us. Am I saying your name correctly,
Reichardt?
Ricard, as in Ricardo Montalban.
Perhaps.
Carol Ricard, president of the D.C. office of Little Diversified Architectural Consulting. David Kepron is with us. He's the creative director. And we're talking about building, the built environment, and how it can be used to make it a better experience for human beings. And we were talking about the color of light and how light changes through the day, natural light changes through the day. And most of us who have been inside office buildings have been around these fluorescent tubes. And now we are reading on our iPads and Surface tablets at night, and we're watching television at night. And these screen devices are casting fundamentally blue light in our eyes, which tells our body to wake up. So are you saying that we should... is there a way to counteract that? If you want to read on
banish your
tablet,
devices.
Turn it off at night.
Yeah, banish your device. There's actually a really interesting free downloadable thing on the internet called Flux, FLUX. Mm-hmm. And you download it, and basically what it does is it calibrates where you are geographically and when sundown occurs, mm-hmm. and it changes the temperature on your monitor. So I have it on my laptop. So it makes my monitor light noticeably more pink. So it's getting rid of the blue spectrum in my monitor, and it's great. It's one of those things that helps you not get that blue light.
Mm. And then there's incandescent lights, which we've used, and that's usually what people have in their homes at night, and that's, for the most part, yellow, except unless you buy those Philips daylight bulbs, mm-hmm. it's fundamentally yellow. And that's a good thing because we go home, we're in a yellow light environment that's telling our bodies to relax, telling our bodies to get ready for sleep. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was actually calibrated when Edison, and you were correct, Edison was the inventor of the light bulb, created the light bulb. He wanted to mimic whale fat burning because that's what it was at the time. That's how people lit their homes. So you're right. It was calibrated to be a golden light.
Mm. Now, these new light bulbs, the LED light bulbs, what color? And I know they come in you can buy them in different color temperatures, but I've never found one, even though it says it's 3,700 degrees Kelvin or whatever the heck they use on the bulb box. I've never found one that really, really is incandescent in its character. And what does that do to us?
LEDs are much more tunable. So theoretically, in the not-too-distant future, we're going to be able to have LEDs. Actually, they have them now. They're just kind of prohibitively expensive. Mm-hmm. There are tunable LEDs that actually mimic natural daylight throughout the course of a day. And there are spaces that are being designed, workspaces, where that's also the case as well, where the daylighting program in the workspace changes the way that the natural daylight would if you were outside and were exposed to natural daylight. So, yes, there are LEDs out there currently that will give you that natural daylight temperature, but they tend to be pretty expensive.
Hmm. It's not just light. It's the way things are set up. It's the way things are designed. And a couple of years ago, I began to notice, and I don't think this is in my imagination at work, but places like restaurants, stores, other places for public consumption began to be themed, Disney-fied. They weren't just places to eat for functionality. They became experiences.
Right.
This is your particular area of expertise, isn't it?
It is indeed, yeah.
You say that shopping environments must evolve into dynamic places, not just spaces. Why?
Well, there's a fundamental difference between those two things for me. And think of it this way. My closet holds my shoes. Mm-hmm. It's a very functional, utilitarian space. Mm-hmm. It's got stuff in it, and that's great. My kitchen, on the other hand, holds the memory of every Thanksgiving I ever ate, every story my parents, you know, told me about where they grew up, every conversation my older brothers had about girlfriends or, you know, what happened in the last inning of the baseball game. Those two things are profoundly different in terms of creating experiences. One is utilitarian and serves just that. The other draws at a very key thing that I, as an experience maker, want to be able to tap into, which is the emotional reaction to environments and people.
Let's talk about kitchens for just a second.
Why not?
When I grew up, a kitchen was a place where you fried chicken. And you might have eaten it at the kitchen table, you know? It didn't have granite countertops. It didn't have a chef's stove. It was just a place to go and make something to eat. And now kitchens have become the focal point of houses. These great big rooms that are open to the rest of the house that look like they were designed, well, they look like they were designed. I mean, they look like they're gorgeous. That's what people want. And yet, most of us don't cook.
Yeah, that's an interesting challenge there, isn't it? You know, I think there's ways to look at that from the anthropological sense of that idea of being around the hearth or being around the fire and what that means intrinsically to all of us. I think we can conjure up pretty easily ideas around that. But I wanted to go back for a second because you said something about there was a tie-in for technology and how it's changing experience. And it is true that the devices that we use have different light quality to them. And that is a for sure thing. But what we know now, which we didn't know years ago, is that repetitive use of digital devices fundamentally changes the neurological structures in your brain. It rewires the neural connections in terms of how you communicate. And so the largest challenge about creating experiences in the future is that if you're growing a culture of people who fundamentally connect through 140 characters or tweeting or doing those things, which I do, and I look at my phone all day long and I'm emailing all the time as well, we're reinforcing neural patterns for communication modalities that are disconnecting us from this kind of thing that we're doing today, which is face-to-face discussion. And so there are studies that are demonstrating that kids graduating college today are 40% less empathic than their predecessors, let's say 30 years ago. And the relationship between where that precipitous drop happened began or has been discovered to have begun close to or around 2002, 2006, where the world of Facebook began to hook in, and we all know that scenario. You're looking at the bus stop, you're in the theater, and everyone's on their phone, and they're sitting across from each other at a restaurant, going back to restaurants, and they're texting each other. So the challenge for placemakers in the future will be, what if you have this whole culture of millennials, you know, you'd mentioned that earlier, who fundamentally don't communicate the same way? Not because they don't want to, but because they haven't reinforced the neural structures to enable them to do that. And then you say, well, if you believe that shopping or any of these things that we do is built on a social paradigm, that people get together because that's so, you know, shopping is about knowing your shopkeeper and that he knows your name and all those things. What if you don't have customers who care so much about doing that? How do you then create places that engage those people? And how do you communicate with them in an effective way that maintains the relevancy of the themed place that you're doing? So it is true that restaurants and retailers, and we're out of that. I think that was a late 90s sort of paradigm where we began. Warner Brothers was doing it. Disney was doing it effectively. And the whole goal was create environments that were engaging multiple senses and tying that emotional connection back to the brand so that I connected those feelings and those positive memories of place with Disney or Warner Brothers or any of those other
or Hard Rock Cafe
or Hard and right so they are because in the end the residual memories of those places are much more important to customer engagement than the actual places themselves.
Tell me why I never enjoyed them.
Well, it's a lot of factors. Could be.
I just thought it was all phony baloney.
Well, it could have. I mean, and that could have been very much true. And I think I suspect that one of the reasons is that people often get this is the interesting thing. We try to create experiences that have lots of opportunities for novelty because our brain loves that. But I think many of the retailers today still also believe that we can give people more than they possibly can ever process at once. And your brain literally goes into a sense of overload. It shuts down for a lot of reasons. Your insula, which is an area that is related to fear and fear perception or fear prediction, kicks in. And people just can't deal. I think that's so. Yeah, go ahead. So it's interesting. I think overwhelm. Mike is breathing, everyone. So it tends to overwhelm the brain with a lot of stuff that you can't possibly absorb, and it actually makes the experience not as pleasurable in the end.
So we're moving away from that, and we're moving into a generation that doesn't look at each other when they talk. And they don't even talk; they text and they communicate via Facebook. They don't look at each other, therefore they are less empathetic because they're not seeing in real time how you are reacting to what's being said or to your environment or what just happened to you. So they can't empathize with you because that's not being communicated. So then if you are a retailer or you're running an office and you want to motivate people either to buy or work, how do you motivate this generation? What's an architect to do with? What does an architecture and design have to do with any of that? How do you do it?
This is like the $65 million question, right? That I think many architects, certainly in the retail world, I know you have similar challenges because it crosses multiple categories. So it's shopping, but it's also urgent care centers. It's educational facilities and how you engage those customers. I tend to always go back to those things that I know I can rely on, which is fundamental experiences, and you know those things that the baseline of emotional connections and how to get at those.
Well, you've written that great retail stores are about creating lasting body memories built on participation in rituals. Now, I read that sentence four or five times yesterday, and I have no idea what you're talking about.
Let me break it down for you.
Explain.
Okay. Let me break it down. Couple things to remember. You know, we all talk about the brain, and when we say brain, we think of that wrinkly thing that's up in your cranium, up mm-hmm. in your skull, you know, that 3-pound mass of tofu. And the reality is that the brain extends beyond the thing that we think it is, right? And we have to remember that the brain grew from the body, not the other way. When we were, you know, think of sort of neurological or human evolutionary history, you had a spinal column first, which grew into a brainstem, which grew into another area, which grew into the thing that we have now is the brain. So we're much more. The brain extends to the heart. There are neurons in the heart. There are neurons in the gut. So when I say heartfelt emotion or gut feeling about certain things, that is specifically because there are neural structures in those areas of your body. So the brain extends to the body. And the body takes in these perceptual responses from the environment, and the body is fully immersed in the world around us. So the brain is feeling your environment all the time. Your body knows, like I said earlier, your body knows the difference between a step on concrete, step on a thick pile carpet. That feedback that we get builds those neural pathways, builds those connections about what we perceive to be certain environmental things that we either like or don't like. And that has been built into us for millions and millions of years.
What are you talking about when you talk about rituals in shopping?
Right. So,
or retail?
The hard thing about getting out of the talk of ritual is people immediately think of it in terms of religious studies. And while it's hard to disconnect those two things, ritual is important. So ritual, talking about sacred place, this is why space and place are different. And the creation of sacred space, time in which the rituals unfold. There's a very clear sequence to when people engage with a brand, hit the store, and what happens in that sequence of events. And the timing of those events are very clear. You know, if you're a coffee drinker, that you go by the local Starbucks and there's everyone lined up at the front door with Starbucks. Well, it's not just getting the coffee that's important. It's the whole sequence of events that happens from the moment they have the idea of stopping at Starbucks to what happens when they're standing in line, who they talk to, what they read, and that's a very definite pattern of events that form what we typically think as rituals. Think of going into a church or sitting in some service. There's a clear way that those events unfold. What happens first? What happens second? What happens third? And so when you talk about stores or other places, we craft experiences that really do have what happens at this point, what happens at this point, what happens, how do I engage? And along that path, mm-hmm. we're always thinking of ways to engage the customers in ways that are relevant. Challenge day is that when you go back to talking about technology, everyone's trying to figure out how to use technology effectively. And what they often don't get, it's not about the device in your store. It's about how that device can be used in the service of what I call technempathy, the relationship between technology and engaging in an empathic extension. So when you go to talking about Apple, we go to Apple stores, and Apple stores are very plain stores. I mean, they're very simple. They're very clean.
They're like the devices they sell.
They are, but you have more people in that store per customer relationship
than
anywhere else. Why? Because Apple gets it in the same way that Starbucks gets it, in the same way as all of our brands that we can name off the top of our
head.
So
why? Tell me why. Why are they all there, and what are they doing? Because they probably all own these products already.
They do. So if I used to go to the hardware store with my kids. My dad took me to the hardware store, and we don't do that anymore. My kids would prefer to go there. Why? Because they're part of a community. They get to play and engage in activities that are new to them. They explore while they're there. Key things to brain activity. And your brain loves novelty. We got to get that. Your brain is all about a novelty-seeking device. That's what it wants. And They have a sense that when they come in, they're addressed by their first name. If we can't take you now, we're going to come back to you in a second. Don't go away. So they're engaged in this process. They're validated, or they are given that sense that they're a valued customer. And their relationship is a key driver to the experience, not the store.
And they're in there with other people who love Apple.
Correct. Oh,
that's it. And when we talk about the millennial generation just being tuned into technology, that's true in a way, but they also seek community around technology. Yeah. So when you're designing a work setting for a younger generation or the millennial generation, we're designing work settings that have more changing work settings that allow different ways of working, so you're not just sitting at a desk all day.
So tell me how this works, because it seems to me, and I'm not pointing a negative finger at Apple, I think what they make is wonderful, but they make these devices that disconnect us because we're so into these devices. They're so wonderful. The Apple iPad and the iMacs, and they're wonderful. And so we live our lives in these devices, and we're disconnected from each other, increasingly so. But yet, we go to the Apple store because we're with people like us who love these products. But we're not really talking to them. We're just around them.
Well, in some respects, that's true. And anyone who's studied sociology and the way that children learn, there's something called parallel play, where children align each other shoulder to shoulder, and they're together, but they're doing their own thing. It's sort of a form of parallel play when you're using your technology device. But you're sitting in a Starbucks, or what's called a third place. Your first place was home. Your second place was work. Third place is in the middle. It's like a Starbucks or Panera or someplace that's got activity that you can either engage in or you can observe. So I have a friend who doesn't work anymore, has retired, but they still go to a Starbucks and they do their own work because they want to be around other people. They don't know all those people. They're not necessarily engaging with everyone, but they want to be around.
And that's that coffee shop mentality where people are in there with their cup of coffee, maybe. If the coffee store is lucky, but they're sitting with their computer doing whatever it is they're doing on their computer, working, surfing the web, sending emails. Nobody's talking. Nobody's interacting. They're all by themselves in their little silo next to the next little silo, and all these little silos are all around. It's weird.
Well, it's interesting. There's a new phenomenon called co-working spaces. So these are spaces for people that don't necessarily have their own company that has 35 people and they need a large space. These are typically entrepreneurs. They're frequently tech entrepreneurs, and they go to these co-working spaces that provide them an office. It's not what we used to call an incubator, but it's evolved a lot. So there are different work settings, there are video teleconference facilities, et cetera, very highly technology driven. But what we found is that after 6 months, 65% of these people are working on projects together. So there is a lot of connecting going on that may not be as obvious or the way that it used to be, that we're familiar with as baby boomers.
So we all know the phenomenon that is coffee shops, where people go to work or isolate themselves or do their own thing on the computer. Has it grown up around coffee shops because it requires a minimal purchase, or is there something about the design of coffee shops that makes people want to be there in 10 seconds or less?
Well, the concept of the third place was coined in the 60s. It was from a book called The Great Good Place, which is about public space and sociology.
Let me let you finish that on the other side. It's not fair to make you do it in 10 seconds. Can't be done. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and American Quilters Society Quilt Week in Charlotte, Wednesday to August 2nd. More than 400 quilts will be on display, plus lots of vendors, workshops, and special events. Charlotte Convention Center, AQSShows.com. We get an update on efforts to address the child migrant crisis, from competing plans from the Senate Democrats and House Republicans to the latest proposals from the White House, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation about the built environment, you can get to us at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks or through Facebook or Twitter, and we are coming right back.
The recent Air Force cheating scandal raised concerns about America's nuclear weapons, from how missile officers are trained...
4, 3, 2, 1, key turn.
...to the future of the aging arsenal.
Choices are going to have to be made, and I think the land-based rocket component is on the chopping block.
Minding the Missiles this week on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 till 6:30 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the built environment and how it can be designed to make you feel better, be healthier, do what the owner of the environment wants you to do, which we'll get into. Carol Ricard is with us, president of the D.C. office of Little. They're an architectural and design consulting firm, and David Kepron is their creative director. Before the break, we were talking about coffee shops and what it is about coffee shops that make people want to go there and do whatever it is they do. And are coffee shops designed for that purpose, or did it just evolve into that purpose? And if you wanted to design a place like that that was not a coffee shop, what would you do?
Well, you do many of the things that the coffee shops currently have, which is in the book The Great Good Place, which was a book about social conventions and gathering places, the writer talked about there need to be a few components. There needs to be food and or drink. There needs to be a convivial atmosphere, so it's got to be lively. Something's got to be going on to keep your attention for you to look at, and you can either decide to join in or just stand from the side and watch. So it's essentially, if you remember the show Cheers, the sitcom,
right,
it's basically Cheers. It's designing something like Cheers. So if you're designing an office, you see the rise of these sort of living room spaces or family room spaces or coffee bars for the same reason. People tend to – it's not the water cooler anymore that people gather around. It's the coffee bar that people gather around, and it sort of rose at the same time that Starbucks was making their big foray into the market and found, you know, a great deal of success with that model.
No one's mentioned the smell, but I think that you walk into a coffee shop and it smells
good. It's an archetypal smell, like bacon, coffee, cinnamon rolls. It's one of those things that lives
kitchen.
In memory.
It's the kitchen. It's the home, warm. The warm,
childhood.
Home fires burning.
Right.
Warm, comforting. Are they lit? Are good coffee shops lit? To enhance that, do they have to be, or is it just the natural light coming in?
I don't know that. Well, generally speaking, they're usually lit. It depends if it's in an inline or if it's on a corner site, or, you know, a lot of times it's depends on the space that they're occupying. But they're lit by the smell.
Yeah.
I remember years ago doing retail, and I was doing work for someone that sold. It was a bakery, and they were telling me to vent half of their smell into the mall because that's what was their big seller.
Yeah.
You know, when you smell those things, it goes right into your memory.
You cannot walk past
Absolutely.
The Cinnabon.
It's impossible.
You have to stop at the Cinnabon. You must. You're writing a book, David, called Retail Revolution with a small r in parenthesis. So it's actually Retail Evolution about creating right-brained stores that will shape the future of shopping in a high-tech, socially networked world. So what would that be like? What would a right-brained store look like? And are there right-brained stores right now?
There are. But the key driver to this is trying to understand what the different relationships are between right and left brain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, left brain, very linear, very logical, very sequential, very numbers-driven, very language-based. It's what helps us speak and understand speech.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, the right brain also understands speech, but it only understands the prosody, the feeling of the words. I can say a word two different ways, and your right brain will pick up whether it's an angry sort of sound or whether it's not. The key here is
– which is the problem with texting, by the way.
Which is exactly the problem with texting, because as a communication modality, you can't tell. And I can't tell you how many times we've all had emails or texts where you think the person's really annoyed, but you're not really sure, and the reverse, right? So the – retailers often lived in this paradigm of pilot high and watch it fly, you know. And so you go in there and there's lots and lots of stuff. And it's driven by price point. Price point was the biggest differentiator, you know, on the scene. And what we now know is that customers don't actually care so much about price point because they can buy the whatever it is cheaper online.
Mm-hmm.
And more is not better. More is actually worse. People get very confused in their environments, and they will become even increasingly confused when they can buy whatever they see in the store times 10 through their digital devices. The right brain is emotional, creative, intuitive, holistic, very keyed into emotion, so relationships and this idea of empathic extension, loves play, and sees the world in a very large sort of view. It puts context together.
Mm-hmm.
So without the right brain, you don't have this idea of where I fit in the sequence of things or how I can relate emotionally to you. In a world where you have technology and you have price points that's becoming less important, you're going to need to rely on something else. And I'm saying you got to go back to the things that have driven us in relationships for millennia, which is connecting to these other things, play, this feeling of being in a place that's playful, and there's ideas of play that are exactly synonymous with shopping.
But how do you do that in a Belk store? I'm just picking on them. But
right.
A department store. How would you do that?
So you start to look at sequence of events, how customers see the process of what they do, which goes back to the idea of ritual practice and how you choreograph. And it's a lot about that. It's a lot about choreographing the sequence of experiences, how customers relate to merchandise presentations and graphics. For example, a price point sign gives them a number. However, a comment from a great sales associate gives them a very different feeling about what it's like to be in that dress, and it ties into all those things that they feel when they begin to say, "You look fabulous in that dress."
Is that what you mean about storytelling? Because you talk about retailers educating consumers through storytelling throughout, and these are your words, throughout the customer journey, through the shopping experience.
Yeah.
Boy, that's, are we overworking this a little bit? I mean,
no,
is that
true? I don't think so. I think, you know, what we know now is the store is not the only place.
Right.
I'm going to say store, but, you know, you can move that across a broader spectrum. It really is. It could be an urgent care clinic.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a store. It could be a number of other things, or it could be a school place as well. We now know that we used to always think about creating experiences for stores, but the customers are getting tapped into brands way earlier. And that starts on their devices that they have, and they're engaging way after, which is engaging them through social media.
So are you talking about people know what they want? They know all about the product before they get to the store to buy.
They often do. They often do. And certainly millennial customers will know more than any shopper that has ever known anything. So the challenge at the retail level is having a sales associate who knows more. And who knows more than the sales associates do. And millennials will go into stores, look at what they want to buy, source it on their phones, and then determine whether or not they're going to buy it there or whether they're simply going to buy it from Amazon when they get home later on because it can be sent to their home. And they do that all the time. And there's lots of studies that demonstrate customers are shopping in stores. We call it now showrooming, and it's a huge challenge because stores are becoming showrooms for stuff. Remember the old service merchandise paradigm? It was a big showroom of stuff.
Right.
And so that's really, in a way, coming around now.
But if you're a retailer, and this is not about selling and buying, it's about architecture and design, but if you're a retailer and people are coming into your store because you are the showroom, and then they're going home or they're actually standing in the store hitting buy on Amazon on their smartphone,
right. They
haven't bought it from you. You're not making any money. You're just serving as a retail showroom for Amazon.
So let's shift out of retail stores and think of another paradigm, and I'm back probably more into Carol's world,
okay. Which
is you go to a hospital or you go to see your doctor. And we know that many of us who will go to the dentist or the doctor or an urgent care clinic feel worse when they're there than they might have when they arrived. And it has a lot to do with the environment. So if you can craft those experiences that are in stores that allow people to feel more relaxed, to reduce that sense of anxiety, to know that they're going to be taken care of, those are key drivers to how people feel about that. And they're likely to go back to that particular healthcare provider.
Well, your company and you, Carol, deal with designing corporate headquarters, which have to have a certain feel about them because it speaks volumes about what the company is, not just what they do, but what they are.
Absolutely.
And what they mean to the world. You do supermarkets, healthcare facilities, justice facilities, schools, restaurants. Pick a couple out there and talk to me about that. Let's talk about schools because everybody talks about, you know, public schools being so bad today, blah, 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 charter schools being better, blah, blah, blah. It's very important, you say, for a charter school to pick the right environment in which to exist.
Absolutely.
What would that be?
It would be something that would be an intuitive design. David speaks about the sequencing of spaces. The reason why everyone likes an iPad or an iDevice or an electronic device, they're well designed. We were talking before about it being intuitive to use. A source of stress for people when they come into a building is if they're not sure where to go, how to use the space, what they're supposed to be doing in the space. So good design really takes into account how they're going to use the space. Design of spaces isn't about housing people. It's not a box that you just stuff people into. The design of space really has to supplement whatever processes are occurring in that space. So if I'm in a school, the way the school is designed needs to help create an immersive learning environment so that the children can learn not only by interacting with the teacher, interacting with their peers, but doing things. We're finding now that when people learn in many different ways. Some people are auditory learners. Some people are visual. Some people are kinetic learners. Being able to teach people in a number of different teaching modalities, helps them retain more and helps find and create an individual learning path for each student.
So if you're going to design a public school or a charter school or a college classroom, mm-hmm. for that matter, how do you apply those principles?
You apply them by making, again, creating different work settings, different places where they can actually do the learning. So it's not just sitting, what we used to call sage on the stage, where somebody's standing up in front of you and speaking at you for the whole time. Now a lot of school districts are going to an inverted classroom where students learn, do their reading at night, which we used to call homework,
right.
and they do their homework during the day in the classroom while the teacher walks around and looks over their shoulder and says, no, this is how you do that. You might need to go back and read this passage again. So it's really looking more specifically at the individual, at the way that they learn, and then designing classrooms around those things to support those processes.
Justice facilities, let's talk about them, because I know that there's a in the material you gave us, there was a picture of a – it looked like a jury waiting room. It could have been something else.
Okay.
Where it was just a blank white wall with
sure.
a TV monitor, which was too small for the wall,
sure.
hanging up in front of a row of seats. And then you put a mural on the wall, which is an African savanna
right.
mural. And you said that the people who work in that environment every day, their heart rate and their blood pressure went down
correct.
When the mural went up.
Correct. There is an evolutionary memory. David was talking before about a lot of the neurological processes in humans being related to evolution. There's a new evolutionary memory that we have. It's called the savanna image. It's something that it's a big wide open plain. Usually there's water, a body of water in it, maybe some trees where you could theoretically seek protection if you needed to. But it's something that we have this vestige of evolution in us. And this was an experiment that we did not do, but another architecture firm and professors from Ohio State University did, where they went to the intake facility in Sonoma County. An intake facility is where people come to be booked. They've just been arrested. It's very stressful. People are upset. Sometimes they're emotionally disturbed. Sometimes they're drunk or they're on additional substances.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very stressful environment. And what they did without telling the people that worked there was install this savanna image. It was 9 feet by 22 feet on one end of the intake facility. And just as you said, they measured blood pressure and other things like galvanic skin response and cortisol levels, et cetera, in the morning.
Of the people who worked there.
Of the people who worked there.
Not the people coming in for intake.
Correct.
Okay.
Because they would hopefully go away eventually. But the people who worked there, and what they found was a significant decrease in stress hormones and blood pressure
mm-hmm.
over the course of 6 weeks for the people who worked there. Consequently, for the people who were being processed there, there were fewer incidents there, fewer people who tried to commit suicide, fewer people who had to be restrained, et cetera. So it has an impact on us whether we know it or not. And that's kind of the key, is we don't know a lot of times.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, even if you don't like the beach, everybody wants to have a place they can go in the Caribbean or someplace like that
mm-hmm.
where they can look out at the white beach curving sure. around with the palm trees and the beautiful blue ocean and blue sky, because you just go
right, and that's why natural views are so important when you're creating space.
Right.
The
mm-hmm.
fact that picture windows became so sought after in the 60s, in residential experience, was because you could project yourself into the natural environment.
Talk to me about this, because for years now, the American dream has been the house in the suburbs with the white picket fence and the green lawn and the backyard full of woods. That's what people wanted. And now the millennials want to live in the city. They want to live in an urban environment. And when they look out their windows in an urban environment, they see the building across the street, or they look down on the air conditioner sitting on top of the building across the street. How do you make that? Maybe they find that attractive, aesthetically pleasing. But if it's not, what do you do about that?
Well, it's a bigger question. It's more about city planning at that point. It's not just the buildings that are created, but they have to be part of a larger complex network where you have pocket parks that are designed within two blocks of where someone lives, so that you can go out and you can go into Central Park. That Central Park's a huge draw in Manhattan because it provides that
yes.
backyard.
Right. John and Charlotte emails, I've worked in some of the best skyscrapers in Charlotte. Architecture-wise, they were still depressing because the bank that owned them cut costs by rarely cleaning them. It's sad, like fine artwork covered in dirt. I would rather work in an ugly but clean space. It is much more optimistic and energizing to be in a clean environment. All right. Conrad on Facebook, as a small retailer and wine shop owner, I'm constantly told by guests that a big part of our popularity is due to the warm, cozy feel of our shop. Lots of wood and wine bottles. They feel like they're dining in a wine cellar. Why is that appealing?
That goes back to our memory of nature. So using natural materials like wood, if you don't have a view of the outside, if you're using natural materials like wood or bricks or things that have texture and color and they're scaled more to a human scale rather than a large monolithic thing,
mm-hmm.
that's also it de-stresses people.
Bill from Matthews emails, I used LED light panels in my video business, which can be tuned from about 3,200 Kelvin yellow light to 5,600 Kelvin blue light. Could companies who tune their lighting be able to create more productive workforces?
Yes.
In a word. The other thing that you write about in your book, and I only have 90 seconds, which is really fascinating to me, is how people approach the shopping experience. I never thought about this, but you're absolutely right that if you don't know where you're going in the store, you don't have a particular destination, you're just killing time, you walk in the front door and you turn right.
You turn, look, move to the right, yeah.
Yeah, and you don't do it at a 90-degree angle. You do it at a 45-degree angle. Is that why, in all these department stores, they put the perfume counter, A, it smells good, at the front of the store, and you have to walk around it? So if you're in a hurry, you walk to the left, right?
It's not quite as simple as that, uh-huh. But yes, it's true. So the key thing really is that you got to understand, our brain is an amazing pattern recognizer. It understands the world in patterns. It learns by getting patterns wrong, and it wants to know what those patterns are. So the moment that you introduce interruptions in these visual patterns and experiential patterns, you get people to look. Mm. And you get people to move, and you get people to do what you want them to do. Our goal, I think, at least in the retail world, is to introduce interruptions in patterns of consistency, things that they typically do every single day, and you change it up, you know, in a different way. Gifts with purchase is all about that. You know, when you go shopping and you got a little black dress and you think it's great, and all of a sudden you get something new, all of a sudden you feel invigorated.
Well, we have just scratched the surface of this, but yeah. I thank you for the time. His book, by the way, is called Retail Revolution with a small r in parenthesis. Carol Ricard and David Keprin from Little Diversified Architectural Consulting.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our associate producer is Alexia Girodi, and the engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, visit our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Healthy Home Market, a local